Lombard Street, A Description of the Money Market by Walter Badgett. Read by Alexander Badgett. Chapter 1, Introductory. I venture to call this essay Lombard Street, and not the money market, or any such phrase, because I wish to deal, and to show that I mean to deal, with concrete realities. A notion prevails that the money market is something so impalpable that it can only be spoken of in very abstract words, and that therefore books on it must always be exceedingly difficult. But I maintain that the money market is as concrete and real as anything else, that it can be described in as plain words, that it is the writer's fault if what he says is not clear. In one respect, however, I admit that I am about to take perhaps an unfair advantage. Half, and more than half, of the supposed difficulty of the money market has arisen out of the controversies as to Peel's Act, and the abstract discussions on the theory on which that act is based, or supposed to be based. But in the ensuing pages, I mean to speak as little as I can of the Act of 1844, and when I do speak of it, I shall deal nearly exclusively with its experienced effects, and scarcely at all, if at all, with its refined basis. For this, I have several reasons. One, that if you say anything about the Act of 1844, it is little matter what else you say, for few will attend to it. Most critics will seize on the passage as to the Act, either to attack it or defend it, as if it were the main point. There has been so much fierce controversy as to this Act of Parliament, and there is still so much animosity, that a single sentence respecting it is far more interesting to very many than a whole book on any other part of the subject. Two hosts of eager disputants on this subject ask of every new writer the one question, are you with us or against us? And they care for little else. Of course, if the Act of 1844 really were, as is commonly thought, the primum mobile of the English money market, the source of all good according to some, and the source of all harm according to others, the extreme irritation excited by an opinion on it would be no reason for not giving a free opinion. A writer on any subject must not neglect its cardinal fact, for fear that others may abuse him. But, in my judgment, the Act of 1844 is only a subordinate matter in the money market. What has to be said on it has been said at disproportionate length. The phenomena connected with it have been magnified into greater relative importance than they at all deserve. We must never forget that a quarter of a century has passed since 1844, a period singularly remarkable for its material progress and almost marvelous in its banking development. Even, therefore, if the facts so much referred to in 1844 had the importance then ascribed to them, and I believe that in some respects they were even then overstated, there would be nothing surprising in finding that in a new world, new phenomena had arisen which now are larger and stronger. In my opinion, this is the truth. Since 1844, Lombard Street is so changed that we cannot judge of it without describing and discussing a most vigorous adult world which then was small and weak. On this account, I wish to say as little as is fairly possible of the Act of 1844, and, as far as I can tell, to isolate and dwell exclusively on the post-Peel agencies, so that those who have had enough of that well-worn theme, and there are very many, may not be wearied, and that the new and neglected parts of the subject may be seen as they really are. The briefest and truest way of describing Lombard Street is to say that it is by far the greatest combination of economical power and economical delicacy that the world has ever seen. Of the greatness of the power, there will be no doubt. Money is economical power. Everyone is aware that England is the greatest moneyed country in the world. Everyone admits that it has much more immediately disposable and ready cash than any other country. But very few persons are aware how much greater the ready balance, the floating loan fund which can be lent to anyone or for any purpose, is in England than it is anywhere else in the world. A very few figures will show how large the London loan fund is, and how much greater it is than any other. The known deposits, the deposits of banks which publish their accounts, are in London, as of the 31st of December, 1872, £120 million. In Paris, as of the 27th of February, 1873, £13 million. New York, in February, 1873, £40 million. And in the German Empire, as of the 31st of January, 1873, £8 million. And the unknown deposits, the deposits in banks which do not publish their accounts, are in London much greater than those many other of those cities. The bankers' deposits of London are many times greater than those of any other city. Those of Great Britain, many times greater than those of any other country. Of course, the deposits of bankers are not a strictly accurate measure of the resources of a money market. On the contrary, much more cash exists out of banks in France and Germany, and in all non-banking countries than could be found in England or Scotland, where banking is developed. But that cash is not, so to speak, money market money. It is not attainable. Nothing but their immense misfortunes, nothing but a vast loan in their own securities could have extracted the hoards of France from the custody of the French people. The offer of no other securities would have tempted them, for they had confidence in no other securities. For all other purposes, the money hoarded was useless and might as well not have been hoarded at all. But the English money is borrowable money. Our people are bolder in dealing with their money than any continental nation. And even if they were not bolder, the mere fact that their money is deposited in a bank makes it far more obtainable. A million in the hands of a single banker is a great power. He can at once lend it where he will, and borrowers can come to him because they know or believe that he has it. But the same sum scattered in tens and fifties through a whole nation is no power at all. No one knows where to find it or whom to ask for it. Concentration of money in banks, though not the sole cause, is the principal cause which has made the money market of London so exceedingly rich, so much beyond that of other countries. The effect is seen constantly. We are asked to lend, and do lend, vast sums which it would be impossible to obtain elsewhere. It is sometimes said that any foreign country can borrow in Lombard Street at a price. Some countries can borrow much cheaper than others, but all, it is said, can have some money if they choose to pay enough for it. Perhaps this is an exaggeration, but confined, as of course it was meant to be, to civilized governments, it is not much of an exaggeration. There are very few civilized governments that could not borrow considerable sums of us if they choose, and most of them seem more and more likely to choose. If any nation wants even to make a railway, especially at all a poor nation, it is sure to come to this country, to the country of banks, for the money. It is true that English bankers are not themselves very great lenders to foreign states, but they are great lenders to those who lend. They advance on foreign stocks, as the phrase is, with a margin. That is, they find 80% of the money, and the nominal lender finds the rest. And it is in this way that vast works are achieved with English aid, which but for that aid would never have been planned. In domestic enterprises, it is the same. We have entirely lost the idea that any undertaking likely to pay, and seen to be likely, can perish for want of money. Yet no idea was more familiar to our ancestors, or is more common now, in most countries. A citizen of London in Queen Elizabeth's time could not have imagined our state of mind. He would have thought that it was of no use inventing railways, if he could have understood what a railway meant, for you would not have been able to collect the capital with which to make them. At this moment, in colonies and all rude countries, there is no large sum of money, of transferable money. There is no fund from which you can borrow, and out of which you can make immense works. Taking the world as a whole, either now or in the past, it is certain that in poor states there is no spare money for new and great undertakings, and that in most rich states the money is too scattered and clings too close to the hands of the owners to be often obtainable in large quantities for new purposes. A place like Lombard Street, where in all but the rarest times money can be always obtained upon good security or upon decent prospects of probable gain, is a luxury which no country has ever enjoyed with even comparable equality before. But though these occasional loans to new enterprises and foreign states are the most conspicuous instances of the power of Lombard Street, they are not by any means the most remarkable or the most important use of that power. English trade is carried on upon borrowed capital to an extent of which few foreigners have an idea, and none of our ancestors could have conceived. In every district, small traders have arisen who discount their bills largely, and with the capital so borrowed, harass and press upon, if they do not eradicate, the old capitalist. The new trader has obviously an immense advantage in the struggle of trade. If a merchant have £50,000 all his own, to gain 10% on it, he must make £5,000 a year and must charge for his goods accordingly. But if another has only £10,000 and borrows £40,000 by discounts, no extreme instance in our modern trade, he has the same capital of £50,000 to use and can sell much cheaper. If the rate at which he borrows be 5%, he will have to pay £2,000 a year. And if, like the old trader, he make £5,000 a year, he will still, after paying his interest, obtain £3,000 a year, or 30% on his £10,000. As most merchants are content with much less than 30%, he will be able, if he wishes, to forego some of that profit, lower the price of the commodity, and drive the old-fashioned trader, the man who trades on his own capital, out of the market. In modern English business, owing to the certainty of obtaining loans on discount of bills or otherwise at a moderate rate of interest, there is a steady bounty on trading with borrowed capital and a constant discouragement to confine yourself solely, or mainly, to your own capital. This increasingly democratic structure of English commerce is very unpopular in many quarters, and its effects are no doubt exceedingly mixed. On the one hand, it prevents the long duration of great families of merchant princes, such as those of Venice and Genoa, who inherited nice cultivation as well as great wealth, and who, to some extent, combined the tastes of an aristocracy with the insight and verve of men of business. These are pushed out, so to say, by the dirty crowd of little men. After a generation or two, they retire into idle luxury. Upon their immense capital, they can only obtain low profits, and these they do not think enough to compensate them for the rough companions and rude manners they must meet in business. This constant leveling of our commercial houses is, too, unfavorable to commercial morality. Great firms, with a reputation which they have received from the past and which they wish to transmit to the future, cannot be guilty of small frauds. They live by a continuity of trade, which detected fraud would spoil. When we scrutinize the reason of the impaired reputation of English goods, we find it is the fault of new men with little money of their own, created by bank discounts. These men want business at once, and they produce an inferior article to get it. They rely on cheapness, and rely successfully. But these defects and others in the democratic structure of commerce are compensated by one great excellence. No country of great hereditary trade, no European country at least, was ever so little sleepy, to use the only fit word, as England. No other was ever so prompt at once to seize new advantages. A country dependent mainly on great merchant princes will never be so prompt. Their commerce perpetually slips more and more into a commerce of routine. A man of large wealth, however intelligent, always thinks, more or less, I have a great income, and I want to keep it. If things go on as they are, I shall certainly keep it, but if they change, I may not keep it. Consequently, he considers every change of circumstance a bore, and thinks of such changes as little as he can. But a new man, who has his way to make in the world, knows that such changes are his opportunities. He is always on the lookout for them, and always heeds them when he finds them. The rough and vulgar structure of English commerce is the secret of its life, for it contains the propensity to variation, which, in the social, as in the animal kingdom, is the principle of progress. In this constant and chronic borrowing, Lombard Street is the great go-between. It is a sort of standing broker between quiet saving districts of the country and the active employing districts. Why particular trade settled in particular places, it is often difficult to say. But one thing is certain, that when a trade has settled in any one spot, it is very difficult for another to oust it. Impossible unless the second place possesses some very great intrinsic advantage. Commerce is curiously conservative in its homes, unless it is imperiously obliged to migrate. Partly from this cause and partly from others, there are whole districts in England which cannot and do not employ their own money. No purely agricultural county does so. The savings of a county with good land, but no manufacturers and no trade, much exceed what can be safely lent in the county. These savings are first lodged in the local banks, are by them sent to London, and are deposited with London bankers or with the bill brokers. In either case, the result is the same. The money thus sent up from the accumulating districts is employed in discounting the bills of the industrial districts. Deposits are made with the bankers and bill brokers in Lombard Street by the bankers of such counties as Somersetshire and Hampshire, And those bill brokers and bankers employ them in the discount of bills from Yorkshire and Lancashire. Lombard Street is thus a perpetual agent between the two great divisions of England, between the rapidly growing districts, where almost any amount of money can be well and easily employed, and the stationary and the declining districts, where there is more money than can be used. This organization is so useful because it is so easily adjusted. Political economists say that capital sets towards the most profitable trades and that it rapidly leaves the less profitable and non-paying trades. But in ordinary countries, this is a slow process, and some persons who want to have ocular demonstration of abstract truths have been inclined to doubt it because they could not see it. In England, however, the process would be visible enough if you could only see the books of the bill brokers and the bankers. Their bill cases, as a rule, are full of the bills drawn in the most profitable trades, and ceteris paribus, and in comparison empty of those drawn in the less profitable. If the iron trade ceases to be as profitable as usual, less iron is sold. The fewer sales, the fewer the bills, and in consequence, the number of iron bills in Lombard Street is diminished. On the other hand, if in consequence of a bad harvest, the corn trade becomes on a sudden profitable, immediately corn bills are created in great numbers, and if good, are discounted in Lombard Street. Thus, English capital runs as surely and instantly where it is most wanted, and where there is most to be made of it, as water runs to find its level. This efficient and instantly ready organization gives us an enormous advantage in competition with less advanced countries. Less advanced, that is, in this particular respect of credit. In a new trade, English capital is instantly at the disposal of persons capable of understanding the new opportunities and of making good use of them. In countries where there is little money to lend, and where that little is lent tardily and reluctantly, enterprising traders are long kept back because they cannot at once borrow the capital, without which skill and knowledge are useless. All sudden trades come to England, and in so doing often disappoint both rational probability and the predictions of philosophers. The Suez Canal is a curious case of this. All predicted that the canal would undo what the discovery of the passage to India round the Cape effected. Before that, all Oriental trade went to ports in the south of Europe and was thence diffused through Europe. That London and Liverpool should be centers of East Indian commerce is a geographical anomaly, which the Suez Canal, it was said, would rectify. The Greeks, said M. de Tocqueville, the Styrians, the Italians, the Dalmatians, and the Sicilians are the people who will use the canal, if any use it. But, on the contrary, the main use of the canal has been by the English. None of the nations named by Tocqueville had the capital, or a tithe of it, ready to build the large screw steamers, which alone can use the canal profitably. Ultimately, these plausible predictions may or may not be right, but as yet they have been quite wrong, not because England has rich people, there are wealthy people in all countries, but because she possesses an unequaled fund of floating money, which will help in a moment any merchant who sees a great prospect of new profit. And not only does this unconscious organization of capital, to use a continental phrase, make the English especially quick in comparison with their neighbors on the continent at seizing on novel mercantile opportunities, but it makes them likely also to retain any trade on which they have once regularly fastened. Mr. McCulloch, following Ricardo, used to teach that all old nations had a special aptitude for trades in which much capital is required. The interest of capital have been reduced in such countries, he argued, by the necessity of continually resorting to inferior soils. They can undersell countries where profit is high in all trades needing great capital. And in this theory, there is doubtless much truth, though it can only be applied in practice after a number of limitations, and with a number of deductions of which the older school of political economists did not take notice. But the same principle plainly and practically applies to England, in consequence of her habitual use of borrowed capital. As has been explained, a new man, with a small capital of his own and a large borrowed capital, can undersell a rich man who depends on his own capital only. The rich man wants the full rate of mercantile profit on the whole of the capital employed in his trade. But the poor man wants only the interest of money, perhaps not a third of the rate of profit, on very much of what he uses, and therefore an income will be an ample recompense to the poor man, which would starve the rich man out of the trade. All the common nations notions about the new competition of foreign countries with England and its dangers, notions in which there is in other aspects much truth required to be reconsidered in relation to this aspect. England has a special machinery for getting into trade new men who will be content with low prices, and this machinery will probably secure her success, for no other country is soon likely to rival it effectually. And there are many other points which might be insisted on, but it would be tedious and useless to elaborate the picture. The main conclusion is very plain, that English trade is become essentially a trade on borrowed capital, and that it is only by this refinement of our banking system that we are able to do the sort of trade we do, or to get through the quantity of it. But an exact proportion to the power of this system is its delicacy. I should hardly say too much if I said its danger. Only our familiarity blinds us to the marvelous nature of the system. There never was so much borrowed money collected in the world as is now collected in London. Of the many millions in Lombard Street, infinitely the greater proportion is held by bankers or others on short notice or on demand. That is to say, the owners could ask for it all any day they please. In a panic, some of them do ask for some of it. If any large fraction of that money really was demanded, our banking system and our industrial system too would be in great danger. Some of those deposits too are of a peculiar and a very distinct nature. Since the Franco-German War, we have become to a much larger extent than before the bankers of Europe. A very large sum of foreign money is on various accounts and for various purposes held there. And in a time of panic, it might be asked for. In 1866, we held only a much smaller sum of foreign money. But that smaller sum was demanded, and we had to pay it at great cost and suffering. And it would be far worse if we had to pay the greater sums we now hold without better resources than we had then. It may be replied that though our instant liabilities are great, our present means are large, that though we have much, we may be asked to pay at any moment. We have very much always ready to pay it with. But on the contrary, there is no country at present, and there never was any country before, in which the ratio of the cash reserve to the bank deposits was so small as it is now in England. So far from our being able to rely on proportional magnitude of our cash in hand, the amount of that cash is so exceedingly small that a bystander almost trembles when he compares its minuteness with the immensity of the credit which rests upon it. Again, it may be said that we need not be alarmed at the magnitude of our credit system or at its refinement, for that we have learned by experience the way of controlling it and always manage it with discretion. But we do not always manage it with discretion. There is the astounding instance of Overend Gurney & Company to the contrary. 10 years ago, that house stood next to the Bank of England in the city of London. It was better known abroad than any similar firm known, perhaps better than any purely English firm. The partners had great estates, which had mostly been made in the business. They still derived an immense income from it. Yet in 6 years, they lost all their own wealth, sold the business to the company, and then lost a large part of the company's capital. And these losses were made in a manner so reckless and so foolish that one would think a child who had lent money in the city of London would have lent it better. After this example, we must not confide too surely in long-established credit or in firmly rooted traditions of business. We must examine the system on which these great masses of money are manipulated and assure ourselves that it is safe and right. But it is not easy to rouse men of business to the task. They let the tide of business float before them. They make money or strive to do so while it passes, and they are unwilling to think where it is going. Even the great collapse of Overend's, though it caused a panic, is beginning to be forgotten. Most men of business think, anyhow, this system will probably last my time. It has gone on a long time and is likely to go on still. But the exact point is that it has not gone on a long time. The collections of these immense sums in one place and in few hands is perfectly new. In 1844, the liabilities of the four great London joint stock banks were £10,637,000. They now are more than £60 million. The private deposits of the Bank of England then were £9 million. They now are £8 million. There was in throughout the country but a fraction of the vast deposit business which now exists. We cannot appeal, therefore, to experience to prove the safety of our system as it now is, for the present magnitude of that system is entirely new. Obviously, a system may be fit to regulate a few millions, and yet inadequate when it is set to cope with many millions. And thus it may be with Lombard Street. So rapid has been its growth, and so unprecedented is its nature. I am by no means an alarmist. I believe that our system, though curious and peculiar, may be worked safely. But if we wish so to work it, we must study it. We must not think we have an easy task when we have a difficult task, or that we are living in a natural state when we are really living in an artificial one. Money will not manage itself, and Lombard Street has a great deal of money to manage. That concludes Chapter 1, read by me, Alexander Badgett. The book Lombard Street is in the public domain, and digital copies are available for free online or on your favorite e-reader. Intro and outro music by Esther Abrami. Follow me on Twitter, @CalebNygaard, and check out our interactive graphics explaining how central banks work today at www.centralverse.org.